You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we hear about a new NCAA commission led by Condoleezza Rice that was formed to help address the scandals the organization has been facing.
First, there are now more than 6,000 craft breweries in the United States, but despite how that looks, Americans' taste in beer really hasn't changed all that much.
The best-selling beers in America are still Bud Light, Coors Light, and Miller Lite. And as our next guest says, craft breweries are adjusting to this reality by brewing more corporate lager-like beers, what he calls blander beers.
So how did so-called bland beers come to dominate American taste? Ranjit Degay joins us now. He's a professor of economics at the State University of New York in Oswego with a specialty in American social and economic history. He recently wrote about this for the website The Conversation. Ranjit, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So I feel like, Ranjit, we're throwing you into the lion's den here a little bit by bringing you onto Wisconsin Public Radio. Folks love their craft beer around here, but despite that, you're saying that bland beer, by and large, still the preferred taste of beer in America. How are you measuring this?
Just by what people are drinking. There's, you know, industry statistics on that. And, yeah, craft beer, as far as what people purchase, as opposed to the dollar value that they spend on it, it's most about 7/8 non-craft beer.
And when you say bland beer, what are the kind of beers that you're talking about?
The light beers in particular. Those are the ones that have the lowest hop content and malt content. Those are the traditional ingredients of beer. All beers have those to some extent. And they have the least of them. So they literally are more watery than other types of beer.
And so we're hearing a lot of craft breweries, they're coming out with like in-your-face IPAs, heavy beers, things like that. That appeals to a certain segment of beer drinkers, I would imagine, but there's still kind of this untapped market, if you will, for people looking for something else. So we are starting to see craft beers maybe dial it back just a little bit to try to capture that mainstream beer drinker.
Yeah, the blonde ales are very popular. I think a lot of the craft beers have a certain snob appeal that's independent of their appeal to taste buds. So some people want something that's not one of the corporate beers, and they go for something that tastes more like one of those. I mean, beer is an acquired taste to begin with.
And so we might think, okay, we've heard about this craft beer explosion. You know, breweries are opening up everywhere. We might be wondering, well, maybe why this isn't more popular. You kind of looked into history to discover how we developed this taste for so-called bland beer to begin with. And you write in your piece that America never really developed a homegrown brewing tradition. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, we're a nation of immigrants. The English immigrants brought with them English ales. And a lot of the hoppy, in-your-face beers that you mentioned, like India Pale Ales, those are really from that English ale tradition. But we were never a big drinking nation of English ales. There was a lot of drinking going on in the early 19th century, but it tended to be spirits, rum and then whiskey in particular. And cider was actually more popular, probably because it was easy to make at home, especially if you had apple trees in your yard, than beer was.
And in those,
so then you have the influx of Germans in the mid-19th century, and German lager was a superior product. It was, you know, very tasty beer. The German lager of the mid-19th century was actually more like dark beer, like a dark lager. It would be like a Heineken Dark or a Beck's Dark, that kind of thing. And it also stored very well. It was very stable. If you opened up one of those, it was probably not going to be, you know, spoiled or skunked.
And you also point out that temperance movements in early America also played a role in some of the rise of the biggest brands that we see today, including Pabst Blue Ribbon here in Wisconsin. Now, I kind of would have assumed that by their nature, temperance movements would have kind of had the opposite effect. So what happens?
Well, the key thing is whether beer is a temperance beverage or not. It sounds a bit ridiculous, you know, if you've ever been on a college campus, to think of beer as a temperance beverage. But compared to whiskey and other spirits, a lot of people thought beer was much milder, certainly, you know, by the ounce it is. And there were a lot of people, including President John Adams, Adam Smith, President James Madison, the New York Times, and the brewers themselves, who said beer is a temperance beverage. If you drink it in moderation, it's not intoxicating. Some brewers even went out on a limb and said it's impossible to get drunk on beer.
And the beers that you're talking about, these aren't the 5, 6, 7% beers that we see today. These were sort of lighter, almost watered-down fare, right?
Well, the beers that were served in the 19th century were somewhere in the range of like 5 to 6%. So that's a pretty moderate range. It's not really what you would call watered down or a light beer, but at the same time, it's not, you know, like the 7% sort of IPAs or imperial stouts. Those are often up 7 to 10% that you would see today.
We are.
So it's a judgment call. It probably was never true that the majority of beer served in America was not intoxicating, but still it was less intoxicating than whiskey or other spirits. So the temperance movement in the mid-19th century focused on spirits, and it had smashing successes. Consumption of whiskey and other spirits went down dramatically, but then you had the big wave of German immigration and the so-called lager beer craze. And the temperance movement had, you know, its work cut out for them.
We are talking right now with Ranjit Dugay. He is a professor of economics at the State University of New York. We are talking about where Americans' taste for so-called blander beers came from. And Ranjit, we had Prohibition in the early 20th century, which you say laid the groundwork for a nation of bland beer drinkers. How did that work?
Yeah, we were kind of on the way there already because the temperance movement really got going right about, well, the prohibition movement, rather. The original temperance movement was a voluntary movement, and it was very successful, as I said, in getting people to take pledges to stop drinking, and especially to stop drinking whiskey. There was an issue. Not everybody agreed whether beer and ale fell into that category. A lot of people in the temperance movement were very uncompromising, and it became more and more so. So then you finally got nationwide prohibition, you know, by 1920, and you had state-level prohibitions before that. The brewers naturally were kind of on the defensive as far as this went. They didn't want to ally themselves with whiskey and other spirits because that's where the temperance movement had its greatest success. So they tried to distance themselves from that and say that they were a temperance beverage. Best way to prove that you're a temperance beverage is for your beverage to look very pale and mild and non-threatening. We didn't have a lot of scientific data on like alcohol by volume and stuff like that by that back then. If it looked very clear and it tasted very bland, then it seemed like it wouldn't be that intoxicating.
Sure. And then Prohibition ends, and then brewers at this point are sort of free to do what they want. But we really didn't see great experimentation in the beer industry until maybe the last 20 years. Is there an easy explanation for what accounts of the 50 to 60 years or so of bland beers dominating the markets?
Yeah, I think so. I think the temperance movement was just, although it was a worldwide movement, is exceptionally strong in this country. Just about everyone had some kind of prohibition around the time of World War One or just after. Ours lasted the longest. 13 years is a very long prohibition. During that time, prohibition, of course, was not completely successful. Things like wine and spirits tended to flourish, especially spirits were very easily concealed. Beer was not. Wine could be made relatively easily at home with wine grapes, which became a big industry all around the country. Beer was a little harder to do. So beer consumption fell off dramatically during Prohibition. And people who flouted Prohibition and drank were generally drinking wine or spirits. So you didn't have a lot of beer consumption during Prohibition, certainly not a lot of selection. The selection had gone down quite a bit in the past, in the 20 or so years before Prohibition, as lager and especially the American Pilsner sort of lager, something like Pabst Blue Ribbon or Budweiser, where it's a small amount of malt and hops adjuncted with corn or rice or some other cereal grain.
And
but after Prohibition, people just weren't really used to much of a variety. There was the dark lagers and so forth that still existed before Prohibition were in very little demand after Prohibition.
And very briefly here, Ranjit, as we wrap up, we're leaving a lot of history on the table, but are bland beers here to stay?
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't want them to go away. This variety is the spice of life, we economists always say. And it's good for people to have a choice. 30 years ago, you really did not have a choice. It was bland beer or nothing. It was bland domestic beer or bland imported beer. But you didn't have the type of choice we have right now.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Ranjit, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much. Enjoyed myself.
Ranjit Dugay is a professor of economics at the University of New York at Oswego. He joined us to talk about how, even amid the craft beer boom, bland beer is here to stay. College basketball is in the final games of March Madness, but there's also madness off the court as the NCAA has been dealing with fraud and scandals that have made national headlines in the past year.
In January, the president of the NCAA announced the formation of a commission that promises to reform men's basketball by the start of next season. But college athletics is a $1 billion-a-year business, so critics are skeptical of anything actually changing.
Here to catch us up on the many issues the NCAA is facing is Jeremy Bauer-Wolf. He's the student affairs and athletics reporter at Inside Higher Ed. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So certainly there's a lot of excitement heading into what's arguably the NCAA's biggest weekend of the year, the Final Four, but it's been anything but smooth sailing this year for the NCAA and men's college basketball. Can you kind of catch us up on some of the issues and scandals that the organization has faced in the last year or so?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the NCAA is certainly not a popular organization right now. I think there have been several high-profile cases that we've seen where the public has disagreed with the NCAA decision. But I think the biggest black eye right now is the scandal surrounding men's college basketball, as you pointed out. So essentially what we have here is at least four high-profile programs that are connected to bribery and corruption. You have some assistant associate coaches steering recruits to certain institutions in exchange for cash payments. Obviously, this has been going on for a while now, and I think any NCAA insider would tell you that. But this is the first time we've really seen this exposed to the greater public, and this is the first time we've really seen the federal government and federal officials really step in on this and make this a priority.
Yeah, so college basketball, huge national pastime. Complaining about college basketball in the NCAA, also a huge national pastime. But as you kind of said, we're seeing some action, some push towards reform. And in January, the president of the NCAA announced the formation of this commission that is promising, in theory, to reform men's basketball by the start of next season. What do we know about this commission so far?
Not too much. Their work has sort of been in the shadows at the moment. We know that it's led by Condoleezza Rice, who is obviously a huge name, both in higher education just around the country. But we don't really know yet what they're going to be suggesting. You know, I think there was a recent interview with the president of the NCAA where he sort of kind of guessed maybe what might come down the line. But certainly some of the bigger reforms that people are asking for, you know, paying athletes or reforming the system to make it significantly more amateur. Right now, I think there's sort of a blurred line between the amateurism and the professional aspect of college sports. So, again, we don't really know a lot. We don't know what they've been doing. We're just sort of waiting to see what they suggest to the NCAA come April.
And the idea of reform, it's kind of a really broad topic, and that sort of brings you to one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you today. Your website, Inside Higher Ed, reached out to a range of college sports experts and people kind of affiliated with athletics to kind of get their take on how best to reform the NCAA. First off, can you give us a sense of who you reached out to for this?
Absolutely. So, like you said, across the board, we reached out to current NCAA membership, so we have quoted an athletics director and member of their Division I council that makes high-profile decisions for the Division I, obviously their biggest. We have some experts in public policy, experts in sports law. We have the former U.S. Ed Secretary, Arne Duncan, who obviously oversaw this and said he sort of knew that these issues existed. So quite a range of views.
And what were the questions that you were asking to all of these individuals?
Twofold. One was, what do you think the NCAA commission should accomplish? But ideally, what do you think they're going to suggest? Because obviously there's a dynamic here, right? We all would love certain ideals, but what do you think realistically the NCAA is actually going to accomplish here?
And it sounds like a lot of the people that you talked to didn't exactly hold back with their comments. Former U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, you mentioned, he actually said in the piece, quote, at a minimum, the NCAA seems wildly irrelevant to what's actually going on. What was behind those comments?
Well, I think Arne has sort of been in this for a while. He's also chairman of the Knight Commission on Athletics, which sort of is a watchdog group for promoting academics. So, again, he's been in the game for a while. He knows these issues. But I think a lot of people who have studied this for a while simply are just not optimistic. You know, we've seen shoe companies influence, Adidas influence Nike, big money in college sports for decades now. And there just hasn't been much movement on it. So when the NCAA comes out with this commission and promises reforms, people are going to be skeptical.
We are talking right now with Jeremy Bauer-Wolf, student affairs and athletics reporter at Inside Higher Ed, and we are looking at efforts to reform the NCAA. And Jeremy, you mentioned the money involved. We're hearing that 2017 was a record year for the NCAA. They're doing quite well, generating over $1 billion in total revenue. So for that organization, I mean, you've got sort of the PR issues on one hand, you've got the money on the other hand. Does the amount of money really outweigh, you know, the need to reform, I guess?
Well, I think a lot of people made this comment in our roundup that there's very little movement from the NCAA leadership to change this because it wouldn't necessarily benefit them. You know, the NCAA is composed of coaches, athletic directors, people with interest in maintaining the status quo. And the NCAA does rake in a lot of money. So there's not necessarily a benefit for these people to say, well, let's overhaul the system. That might not favor them in the future.
Is part of the issue that any change that you make to the NCAA that might be aimed at college basketball, that a change could have a sort of a trickle-down effect in that it could affect sports all across the spectrum?
Sure. I mean, I think you could argue that if there were major changes to college basketball, and I think a lot of people say that college basketball is the major offender for some of this corruption, I think it would shine a light on some of the NCAA's other practices. Again, I mentioned the UNC case where they ruled that there was no academic fraud involved. I think if there were reforms to college basketball, there would likely be a movement to say, well, can't the NCAA enforcement arm be a little bit more heavy and hard-hitting? So you sort of get the ball rolling with this, and it opens up a whole host of other issues.
You also heard from some experts who brought up this one-and-done phenomenon in men's basketball. Can you tell us more about what that is and how an NBA kind of plays a role in this as well?
Absolutely. I think the NBA actually is sort of the primary focus for the one-and-done. So one-and-done is basically, you know, you have a player, a very good player, come in and commit to a single season in a college and then go professional. And so there are a number of issues associated with this. You know, I think the NCAA and higher ed around the country would like to think that the primary goal of student athletes is not to be on a team, but to rather further their academic career. You know, we know that there's very few college athletes who actually make it professionally. So it behooves them to have a backup plan. My point being with all this is that the one and done rule has existed because the NBA made their rule saying, no, I'm sorry, you can't jump directly from high school to the professionals. They thought that was an issue there. So I think there is a push among the NCAA, and I think they're in talks with the NBA right now. People have previously reported to maybe reconsider this because this wasn't a longstanding rule. This is fairly new in the past two decades or so.
And I think when you have the exciting prospect in the NCAA playing basketball, you start to see sort of the agents swirling around, maybe starting to generate some interest. Does part of a reform package mean restricting what agents can and can't do with college recruits?
And yeah, that was a number of people suggested that. I think there is and that was pointed out, there is a huge swath of agents who are sort of operating underground, right? And this keeps the agents who are maybe above the board, they want to stay away because they sort of know how the system works right now. So it's a little bit difficult for the NCAA to have certain reach, but I think this is certainly an idea being discussed.
So the idea of paying players, it seems like that idea in and of itself might be off the table for right now. However, on the other hand, there seems to be some movement on this idea that maybe athletes could be allowed to profit off their images, their likenesses. This kind of stems back from the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit. He was the former UCLA basketball star who claimed that college athletes should be allowed to profit off their name and their likeness. Is this the area that you think, or that experts think as well, might be the area that we see the reform, that we see players potentially making some money off of what they're doing?
It is certainly a discussion point. I think it's a major frustration, too, for some college athletes. I wrote about a lawsuit very recently out of Central Florida where a football player had a very popular YouTube channel where he showcased his football skills. And he was actually kicked off the team because it was sort of an ultimatum. You know, we want you to give up this YouTube channel making money off of this in order to play football. And it was something he had started even before he had entered college. So I think it is a major frustration for a lot of people. But I think the counterargument there, too, is a lot of people say, well, this blurs the lines of amateurism and professionalism even more. You know, ideally, we would like to think that college athletics is amateur. It is not. It doesn't have all the rules. It doesn't have all the complications associated with this. So when you start introducing things like making money off your image, it does require a huge overhaul of the system and a lot of new considerations.
And briefly, as we wrap up, you had mentioned YouTube, and I hadn't really thought about this before, but is the NCAA always kind of running just a little bit behind where technology is and ways athletes are finding to get themselves out there?
I think there's certainly more opportunities for just young people in general to cultivate their image. You know, the case I referenced, there are a lot of high schoolers, early college students who are taking advantage of Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat to build their brands. And people want this. People seek this. This is sort of why college athletics and especially college basketball is so popular, because it's sort of an intimate tie to a lot of the players, a lot of the action. It's just discussed so much. So when you have these new platforms, it does sort of force the NCAA to reconsider. And when Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, was making his speech to the membership earlier this year, he referenced this, that a lot of the rules that they've had sort of have fallen behind. You know, they really need these reforms because there is just an entirely new environment.
Well, it sounds like a lot to keep track of, and we'll have to bring you back, Jeremy, and hear more in the future. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Bauer-Wolf, student affairs and athletics reporter at Inside Higher Ed. We've been talking about the issues facing the NCAA and the formation of a commission to address them.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, the landmark legal decision Brown versus the Board of Education ended school segregation in America. We look at the legacy of plaintiff Linda Brown, who died this week.
First, in addition to choosing a new state Supreme Court justice, voters on Tuesday will decide whether it's time to eliminate or to preserve the state treasurer's office.
The constitutional position has existed since Wisconsin became a state in 1848. That's 180 years ago. Lawmakers voted in consecutive sessions to get rid of the office. Now it must be approved by voters in a statewide referendum.
Those who want to do away with it say the office has been stripped of so many duties that it's no longer needed. But supporters of the treasurer's office say it provides an important check on the executive branch.
And we want to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234. Is it time to eliminate the state treasurer position, or does Wisconsin need this post? What questions do you have about what the state treasurer does or used to do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Current Treasurer Matt Adamczyk ran for the position in 2014 on a platform of closing the office. He joins us now to make that case. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Judith.
So, Matt, what do you do as state treasurer?
Well, basically, Judith, the duties have been stripped, as your little entrance there, and the role has basically become the constitutional requirement that's left of serving on the Board of Commissioners among public lands. And that is an important board. There's a lot of money over there. And, you know, they give that money to K-12 public schools every year, and none of that's going to change. Everybody wants that to stay the same, that they give back money to the schools. That's constitutional. All we're doing in this amendment is taking out the word state treasurer and replacing it with the word lieutenant governor, so that the three people that serve on the board, the makeup just changes ever so slightly. And that's because the duties of the treasurer have been, you know, as you said, stripped over the last, you know, few decades here.
So those who want to keep the office, like former Treasurer Jack Voigt, who we'll talk with in a few minutes, say it serves as a check on executive power. And he gives the example in a WPR news story that if the Treasurer's office goes, we can kiss the Secretary of State's office goodbye. Also, those have been linked. And the Commissioners of Public Lands going to the Lieutenant Governor would mean more power for the executive branch. How would you respond to that proposal?
Well, I mean, I guess the only thing that people are voting for, everyone, person listening right now, is only going to vote on getting rid of the state treasurer. That's what we're dealing with. And the reality is that the treasurer's office does not have many duties left. So why would we keep the office and keep paying people to do the jobs and have staff and so forth? And as for that Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, whether it's the lieutenant governor on the board or the state treasurer, I mean, before my time, there was probably no questions hardly ever asked. Almost every motion before the board passed 3-0, 3-0, 3-0. I'm probably the only person that's ever really, kind of rocked the boat over that Board of Commissioners of Public Lands. So whether the lieutenant governor's on there, whether it's Republican, Democrat, I don't think it makes a whole heck of a lot of difference. And that's why things in the past, like the State Journal and the Journal Sentinel, have editorialized saying, let's get rid of these offices. It's small victories for small government. Let's do it.
And the name state treasurer would seem to imply that there's a fiscal responsibility, but it doesn't sound like that is, at least at this point. Does the state treasurer have any fiscal responsibility that would not be covered if this position were eliminated?
No, I mean, realistically, like I said, the board is the only constitutional left. Almost statutorily, almost every program that was here has been moved. And, when Jack talks about it in a little bit, one of the biggest things that they gave up was cash management, and that was under his when he was the state treasurer. So many of this has been moved over and been moved to other agencies. And I guess what some of your listeners, I'd like to explain to them, why were these things moved over there? One of the last, probably most important thing that the office had was something called unclaimed property. Mm-hmm. So that would be, Judith, somebody like yourself, let's say you have $70 in an old checking account. You would have had in the past apply to the state treasurer's office to get your money back. What the Department of Revenue is doing, which now has that role, is that in many cases they match your Social Security and they just send, Judith, you just get your check sent right to you. So you don't even have to make a claim anymore. So there's a lot about efficiency in government. And when we did that bill, I think it passed unanimously in both houses. So
we're talking with Matt Adamczyk right now. He is the current Wisconsin state treasurer, and he is encouraging Wisconsin voters to vote on a referendum on Tuesday that would eliminate that position. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we have Vicki on the line in Madison. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I'd like to just point out that Matt's comment that changing the makeup of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands will change it ever so slightly really is rather disingenuous, because by putting the lieutenant governor on that board, it now puts more power in the hands of the governorship, who's ever in power, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. The other thing is, by eliminating this position, it really saves no money but one position, which is a state treasurer. All those duties are still done by other agencies, and those duties should be shifted back to the state treasurer's office, and that constitutional amendment needs to fail. Thank you.
Thanks for that call, Vicki. And Matt, would you like to respond to that?
It's weird. I talked about this once before, and I think we had a Vicki call in the first call as well last time, but I don't know if it's the same Vicki, but giving it over to the lieutenant governor, I mean, we have a lieutenant governor. We're going to have a lieutenant governor. That's a position that nobody's talking about getting rid of. It's just one more duty for that person to have. And that person, is independently elected. I know they run on the same ticket, but they are originally elected on a primary ballot. And they are their own constitutionally elected office. And, I mean, the current lieutenant governor and governor do get along pretty well, but I think probably some of your listeners know in the past that there's many governors and lieutenant governors that did not see eye to eye. So they are their own person, and that person, the lieutenant governor, he or she themselves, they would be the ones that would make the vote, just like the current state treasurer does. So it's just a different person serving on the board, and them making money like they do now off investments, that's still going to happen. So us giving money to the schools, that's not going to change.
Matt, I'm curious why you chose to run for state treasurer when you don't believe that the position should exist. Was it to have that platform to advocate for that?
100%, Drew. That's exactly it. I mean, this is now the second time. My predecessor also ran on the platform of eliminating the office, and he initially kind of kept that plan, but then he kind of changed his position, and I think partly that was because of his deputy was running for the office and wanted to keep the office. But in order to get this done, you actually needed to have a state treasurer work with the legislature, make sure that they push it and actively push the legislature to do this, because to change the state constitution is a difficult task. You have to pass a bill amendment twice, so Assembly, Senate, two times in a row. Now it goes to the people. But I wanted to make sure we advocated for it, and there was nobody else running to get rid of it. So.
All right. Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Jimmy in Valley Junction is up. Hi, Jimmy.
Afternoon. I had a question and a comment. So the duties of the treasurer were done away through mostly through constitutional amendments, or were they siphoned off by the executive and the legislature? I guess that's my question.
Okay.
And my comment is, why stop there? You know, I think probably we could do with half the senators and half the assembly people, and I'd start with Voss and Fitzgerald.
All right, thanks for that call, Jimmy. So that's a good question. So, Matt, you were saying that many duties have been stripped away. This is a constitutionally mandated position. How much does the Constitution say what this job actually entails?
Well, no, that's actually a really good question. But basically, the Constitution only has one duty for the treasurer, and that's serving on that Board of Commissioners of Public Lands. Everything else has been given to the treasurer has done throughout the whole time. It's been statutorial. So basically, if the legislature and the governor change the law, then therefore there's no more duties, or they add duties or whatever. But that was a good question. The duties have been stripped by over the legislature, and it hasn't been only under Governor Walker. To be honest, most of it happened probably in the last 20 years or so.
Matt, if this position, the state treasurer's position, is eliminated, where would the state treasurer's current salary be reallocated?
More or less, the money that comes for the treasurer's office is funded. It's kind of a difficult process, but it comes from the unclaimed property fund, and so then they would ultimately go back there, and I think it would be more or less eventually benefit the public schools, because it has to go back to the common school fund eventually.
And as we wrap up, Matt, how confident are you that voters will approve the referendum on Tuesday to eliminate the state treasurer's office? And when would that take effect if it is?
Well, it's a good question. And basically, my understanding is, you know, it's up to the people. I mean, there's no way to poll this, but, you know, I think oftentimes when citizens are given an opportunity to make government a little bit smaller, they usually vote yes, but I can't say for certain what the vote's going to come out. I mean, there's certainly not been a poll done on it, but I think most people will say, let's make government just a little bit smaller. And so I'm hoping that people do vote on April 3rd and they do vote yes to eliminate the office.
And when would that take effect if they do?
Pretty much once it's ratified.
Okay. Well, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. We
appreciate
you taking the time.
Thank you, Judith.
Matt Adamczyk is currently the Wisconsin State Treasurer, but he's not running for re-election. Instead, he's running this fall for a state assembly seat in the Milwaukee area.
After the break, we'll talk with former State Treasurer Jack Voigt about why he says the office needs to be maintained. And we're welcoming your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Will you be voting to keep or eliminate the position, and why? What do you want to know about what the State Treasurer does or used to do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation on whether the state treasurer's office should be eliminated or saved. Voters will decide in a statewide referendum on Tuesday what will happen with that position.
We want to hear what you have to say at 800-642-1234. Does Wisconsin need a state treasurer, or are we better off getting rid of it? How do you plan on voting on Tuesday, and why? What do you want to know about what the state treasurer does or used to do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org.
We just heard from current treasurer Matt Adamczyk, who wants to get rid of the post. Now we go to former treasurer Jack Voigt. He served from 1995 to 2007 and wants the state to keep the position. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Well, thanks for joining us. Jack, can you tell us how the state treasurer's post has changed since you held that office from 1995 to 2007?
Well, it has changed drastically under the leadership of the governor and the legislature, because they really want, it's all about the money. And certainly the Public Lands Commission has $1.2 billion of investments, and this is the last piece where they can exercise the control of the flow of money, investments, and everything else. And I'm totally opposed to this idea. It's purely nothing Mr. Jamtik said is actually correct. It was stripped intentionally by him and his different ringleaders there in Madison to make certain that there be no duties in that office over the past 8 years. And that makes it rather convenient for the voters to say yes to this, because it's been now really an empty office of doing nothing. And what? I'm opposed to this, because we need to have a fiscal watchdog for the taxpayers of Wisconsin.
Well, I guess someone could say, if those duties have been stripped from this office and if there's no movement to change it back to what maybe the office used to be, maybe at this point, reality being what it is, there is no reason to keep it.
Oh, I think there's a number of reasons. Well, we've had a state treasurer because the founders or the framers of our state constitution made it quite clear in our state constitution, that there be fiscal checks and balances and separate and apart from this office be separate and apart from the executive legislative branches. So it was very clear at the very beginning, before the constitution was even founded, that to have this separation of powers and having make certain that there's a elected fiscal watchdog for our state. And so what's happened is that all governors, I don't care Republican or Democrat, they love power. And this is a power grab that should not be even on the ballot, because it is I'm a constitutionalist, and I really believe we should believe what the Constitution says. The rule of law is important. And certainly we would be the only state not to have an elected fiscal watchdog or treasurer in our state of Wisconsin, in the nation. So we need that independent fiscal voice to be not to be eliminated because, well, for example, all corporations in Wisconsin, all organizations, all political campaigns have a treasurer. Do we need a governor to be the CEO and also the CFO of our state? I say that is not right. And we don't need to have the governor, regardless of Republican or Democrat, to be the CFO and the CEO of our state.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Cindy in Burlington is up first. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I am going to vote no for this, and I would like to see more of their duties reinstated. And if the Democrats take over enough control of the state of Wisconsin, that will happen. And I do not trust this going into the hands of the GOP, especially Rebecca Clayfish and Walker, because our public lands will be sold off without our knowing it, and there will be nothing we can do about it.
All right. Thanks for that call, Cindy. And Jack, it seems like that position on the Public Lands Board is pretty key for many people who oppose eliminating the position.
Absolutely. The bill has already been passed in the Assembly and was going to be passed in the Senate because a bill of to move all the investments to the State Investment Board. Now, again, they may have credible ideas how to invest and to distribute their earnings. But again, there's been a policy in place by the three Commission of Public Lands to fund public school libraries. That could change easily. And when I was state treasurer, we had problems with the State Investment Board of $95 million of Mexican derivatives that were purchased. Again, a watchdog needs to be there to make certain these things are in place. And also the 80,000 acres of public lands, of timberlands, there is a movement afoot to transfer those timberlands to a county forest or to be sold to a major lumber company. And again, we're going back 170 years. It was meant to be a constitutional agency, and it's the only one in Wisconsin that is so. And I already believe we're upsetting the apple cart here by moving in this direction, having more control by the governor's office on this particular position, a constitutional position, which will change in the future. But there's always going to be checks and balances that should be in place, regardless of the time and to make certain that this is done for our citizens of Wisconsin.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jeff in Burlington is up next. Hi, Jeff.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What would you like to say?
I am also opposed to eliminating the treasurer's position. There is a little-known program in the state which has a trust fund consisting of monies derived from the public lands. And that pool of money is currently available to be borrowed from by municipalities, villages, and towns who frequently have emergency large-scale spending that becomes necessary when a bridge fails or something of that nature occurs. That fund loans at very low interest rates and makes the loans very quickly and keeps the taxpayers burden when an emergency of that nature occurs to a minimum. Now, if the Treasurer's Department goes away, the Lieutenant Governor gets a seat on the Board of Governors. The Governor is already on record as wanting to take that pool of money and invest it in Wall Street, and we don't know where the proceeds would go.
All right. We'll stop you there, Jeff, just so we make sure that Jack Voigt can respond to that. So there is, it sounds like, some fiscal oversight, at least in relation to this kind of rainy day fund.
Well, it's not really a rainy day fund. It's actually a fund of investments that is controlled by the policy of the Commissioner of Public Lands. Now, this bill was to be passed by the Senate, but fortunately, Senator Wingard decided not to put it on the Senate floor for a vote. But this would have been passed because the state assembly did pass the bill to move the $1.2 billion to the State Investment Board. Now, again, once they got control of those monies, they'll decide where it's invested as well as where the earnings will go. Again, it's not going to be decided by the three Commissioner of Public Lands because then it becomes a shell again. Just like intentionally stripping the duties of the Commissioner of Public Lands to be a shell of an agency that has no powers, because all the investments will be there at the City Investment Board, and as well as possibly the timberlands will be also stripped of management as well. So again, here we go, more control to the executive branch.
And Jack, as we start wrapping up here, you said earlier that every other state has a treasurer, and we did actually do a quick check on that, and every state
I didn't say that. I said every state has a fiscal elected watchdog or treasurer.
Right, yeah. And I was actually going to say we did check that, and that's correct, that every state either has a treasurer or some kind of comptroller of public accounts. So if Wisconsin were to eliminate this and become the only state that does not have that oversight, what would we be losing?
Well, again, we'd be losing, number one, I think a constitutional separation of powers as well as the checks and balances would be lost. Our fiscal watchdog will not be there when I was treasurer, I both advocated as a critic a number of financial issues in Wisconsin. And I took on both Democrats and Republicans when I was treasurer. And that would be lost. The fiscal voice would be lost.
And we'll have to leave it there. Jack Voigt, thanks for joining us. Jack is a former Wisconsin State Treasurer, supports maintaining that office. Earlier, we heard from current Treasurer Matt Adamczyk, who wants to see it eliminated. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joins us to discuss concerns about voters who have been purged from the voting rolls in error with elections coming up.